No one says you have to be completely confident in order to heal your relationship with money, or be completely confident in order to do some of the things that you want to do with money. And I think that in the doing, that's where the confidence comes. And I think in the doing, that's where the healing comes as well.
Money is often really hard to talk about. There is always a social taboo at play when women talk about their own success, for example. But a lot of us also have problematic feelings about managing our money, not to mention that nagging anxiety when you're not doing it right. So how can we start to heal and make smart financial choices? Hello, everyone. I'm Celeste Headlee. Welcome to Women Amplified from the Conferences for Women. In this episode, I speak to Kara Stevens, also known as the Frugal Feminista. She is the author of Heal Your Relationship with Money, and she coaches women on how to make your money work for you without sacrificing a comfortable lifestyle. You're going to learn some actionable tips you can use right now to start managing your finances in a healthy way, and you'll also learn about your emotional relationship with money and how you can start to heal it. What does it mean to be good with money? I mean, everyone assumes that somebody who is an accountant or a CPA is good with money. But for your average person, what does that look like, someone who is good with money?
I think when you're talking about being good with money, it's twofold. It's having one, a neutral or at least a healthy relationship with money, where you don't have tons of anxiety or shame or just overall negative feelings when it comes to spending, saving, earning, asking for things that you want when it comes to money, saying no around lending. And then I say the second part is the tactical things, like you actually have structures and systems in place that allow you to budget, that allow you to eliminate debt, that allow you to monitor your credit, that allow you to easily save for retirement, that allows you to also think about other ways to invest your money, whether it be for a philanthropic reason or for any other type of social impact reason. So when it comes to being good with money, I think it's multi-leveled. And I think it also is also a very personal experience with money. But in general, it's an ease or a feeling of ease when it comes to money.
So, I mean, we're going to talk more about how you go about healing your relationship with money. But I wanted to talk first about how things have changed in recent years. And by that, I mean whether or not people are feeling more anxiety since the gig economy became more prevalent. Because it's one thing to handle your finances and your budget when you have a steady income coming in, but a lot of people don't.
Yeah, I think that there is something to be said around how the gig economy has impacted how we do manage our finances. On the one hand, the gig economy has offered a level of, I would say, flexibility and time freedom that many of us may have never thought could be possible having a traditional 9-to-5. Some of it is by choice and some of it is by circumstance. And I think when it comes to understanding the gig economy, there's a range of touch points and a range of financial experiences even within the gig economy. So some people, when it comes to gigs and they're highly skilled and they have a client base that may be more funded, they may find that having gigs may be a lucrative way to meet their means at the end of the month. Whereas on the other hand, gigs that are, say, driving or babysitting or house sitting that have to be cobbled together in order to meet your financial goals may be viewed more as a supplement to maybe having a 9-to-5 than having it as your sole source of income. And in the cases that the gig economy is your sole source of income, it's getting clear about what are my basic monetary needs in terms of survival and living expenses for the month. What are my long-term goals? And then which of these gigs, the pay on it, or maybe the ability to negotiate pay, will allow me to actually meet those goals more readily than if I hadn't actually thought about these various factors contributing to choosing one over the other.
So when you begin to start even acknowledging that perhaps you feel anxious about money. What's the first step after you've acknowledged, I don't feel good about the way I spend or the way I save?
I think the step after that is to allow yourself grace in feeling the way that you do feel. I think that beating up on yourself doesn't really help you actually come up with a plan. And I think once you're able to identify that you have a new way or an improved way that you want to begin to deal with your anxiety around money, it's being able to identify what exactly is it that I want to be able to do, even in the smallest of ways, and being able to make steps towards that. So for example, if you're saying that you're anxious around money, you may want to ask, why am I anxious around money? And if the reason is because I'm spending more than I anticipated or expected, you can go back and say, what are some of the reasons that I spent more than I expected to this month? What are some of the ways, maybe for next month, can I begin to put in some stop gaps or put in some systems or put in some plans that will allow me to at least live within my means for the next month, even if it's in a particular category? And I think once you're able to offer yourself the grace and then be able to think about what's the next best step that you can be able to take in order to get to that next experience with money that you want to have, you'll be in a good position to be able to sustain that feeling and that practice.
This can all take time, right? I mean, you talk about identifying that your relationship with money was coming from a place of scarcity. And you've also said that it took you quite a bit of therapy in order to sort of address what was driving that, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that part of the process of giving yourself grace is giving yourself grace as long as you need to give yourself grace. I think that the process of having a healthy relationship with money or even healing your relationship with money is a recursive process. So there'll be times when you experience lots of wins and you're able to say, wow, I stayed within my budget, or I was able to say no, or I was able to wait for a couple of days before I made a purchase. I was able to ask for what I needed at work, or I was able to put allocation for my retirement plan. And then once you're able to, say, stack those wins, when you come into a point where you do make a mistake, you overspend, or you have a moment of a low point where you go against what you might have planned to do, you're still able to have a better perspective and a broader perspective in seeing that the process towards having a healthy relationship with money is one that is a combination of ups and downs, and that it's a normal process. So when you're going through the process of healing your relationship with money, there's going to be ups and downs. And I think having a realistic and compassionate approach to transformation allows you to see the larger perspective, that over the course of a month, you may have a number of ups and downs with your finances. And then when that compounds into 6 months, you see that there were a number of wins and a couple of setbacks, but it doesn't stop you from moving forward. And I think that time is an important piece when it comes to healing in anything, in addition to money, in addition to grief or any other aspects of our lives, that when you do the work and you stay consistent with whatever it is that you're going towards, you'll see the results, but it does take time. And that's okay, because along the way, you're hitting certain milestones of success.
You've talked before about the feelings of shame many people have when they make mistakes with their money. But I wanted to touch on anger. And I say that because when I sit down to handle my finances, I often find I get really angry. I get angry because I'm a freelancer and corporations are allowed to be late paying me, but I'm not allowed to be late paying my bills. I'm angry because, look, we're in late stage capitalism. Wages have not at all kept pace with productivity, and that feels unfair to me. Like, there's this feeling of injustice for me associated with money that just leads the entire subject to feel a little fraught.
Really? Yeah, I mean, that's a relatable, and that's absolutely fair. I've had similar experiences of not being paid, being paid late. And one of the things that I've been able to do in terms of advocating for myself is putting in my contracts, kill fees, or just the parameters under which I'll be paid under certain circumstances, regardless of the project not being completed, if it's the on the error of the client. And I think being able to, number one, offer yourself those legal supports can allay some of the anger. And I think, too, being in community with other freelancers and asking them for support about, hey, how did you handle this situation? What are some other resources? Who can you put me in touch with? Can make you feel a little bit less alone in the process of being a freelancer in this larger world of corporations and oftentimes how we may feel exploited as freelancers. And I would say even third, if it's possible, creating, there's like freelancer unions that you can join that can also help you feel a little bit less, in addition to your colleagues who are freelancers, give you actually more information about what your rights are as a freelancer. And so you can feel that you're armed with enough information to be able to protect yourself. And I would say even four, in my experience, in working one-on-one with the person on the other side, the other client, and being very upfront in the onboarding conversation about what your expectations are in terms of a working relationship. And sometimes it may mean not going forward with a contract because you know that in this instance, it may seem more of a hassle to be with this client than actually have the money. And I know sometimes that can be a privilege and a luxury, but it is worth thinking about, is this a client that's worth my time? And I'll even add, I'm adding another one just off the top of my head, is that having a referral system amongst your colleagues about who are actually excellent clients to have and to retain, that allows you to be a little bit more buffered against the wild, wild west. That's the freelance world at times.
That's really helpful, I think. And I wonder if we can pick up our process back where we left it. In other words, you were talking before about what your first step after you've acknowledged that, you know, you have anxiety surrounding money, that perhaps you're not addressing issues because of negative feelings surrounding finances. So what happens next as you begin to sort of make your priorities in terms of your finances? How do you do that? How do you decide what is the most important and what can wait?
I think it's two part. I think one is a head experience. Another one is a heart experience. So what I mean by that is looking at where you are in life and what your immediate goals are. So you have your monthly expenses that you have to look at. So getting clear about what exactly are your expenses for the month. So I would say first, your priorities are creating a budget. And that comes from actually understanding what your expenses are. And understanding your expenses comes from at least tracking how do you actually spend your money every month, right? And so being clear about how much money do I really need to have the bare minimum of my expenses met. And when I say bare minimum, I'm talking about housing, transportation, food, and possibly medicine, right? Once you have that number, then you're able to look at the other categories of your budget to see what are the ways in which I can safeguard this amount of money to ensure that the next time, say, for example, I have my next payment, whether I be a freelancer or whether I be someone at 9 to 5, how am I making sure that these needs are met? So that's the first thing. I would say, secondly, after creating a budget and knowing what happens at the budget level, I think it's really important that we begin to think about what is my overall wealth. A lot of us don't talk about what is my net worth because we're looking only at the budget level. So when it comes to understanding your net worth, meaning how much wealth do you have, that's the assets, the things that you own, versus your liabilities, the things that you owe, it's getting clear about what is that number. Because sometimes when we only look at the budget level, we can actually lose sight that we're doing a lot better than we think we are when it comes to our overall progress in our finances. And I would say even after that is getting clear about long-term planning so you don't lose sight of it once you're going from month to month. and in particular when it comes to whether it be freelancers or people with a 9-to-5, is making sure that you are doing all that you can, even if it's in the smallest amount, to contribute to a retirement account, whether it's an employee-sponsored one or it's something that, as a self-employed person, you do yourself, whether it be a SEP IRA or a simple IRA, whatever form of retirement, individual retirement accounts you put aside, you're making sure that those are your top priorities. And I think in addition to just having those basic needs met, it's also, what are your values? What are some of the things that you want to do for yourself when it comes to finances in the next 2 to 5 years? And with that, it's being clear, what are some of the, maybe, do I want to buy a home? Do I want to buy a car? Do I want to travel? And creating two things. One, it's a sinking fund, which is an account that you put money towards readily towards a goal that you know is going to come down the line and something that you actually want to do. And I would say second is building an emergency fund. An emergency fund is where you house, similar to that number of your basic expenses, at least 3 to 6 months of your living expenses in the event of a job loss or an event you decide that you no longer want to continue a relationship with a client. That will begin to help you see, if I am able to meet these particular goals, I'll be in a better position to have more flexibility down the line about changing and shifting them as my needs change or as my values change in the moment.
You're listening to my conversation with Kara Stevens, the Frugal Feminista. Texas listeners, save the date. Tickets to the October 2nd Texas Conference for Women in Austin go on sale Wednesday, May 1st at 12 noon Central Time. We are going big for our 25th anniversary, so do not miss out on being there with truly some remarkable speakers and some surprises. So mark your calendar for Wednesday, May 1st, and then stay tuned to your email. We'll have some very special speaker announcements. Now, let's get back to our conversation. This is all fascinating, and one of the things I love about your writing is how you make all of these steps so clear and, yeah, and not frightening.
Yeah.
And I wanted to break it down. Let's start with the budget. So how much tracking do I need to do? In other words, here we are. It's the middle of the year, essentially. So if I were to only track, say, 30 to 60 days of my spending, it wouldn't include maybe some of the extraordinary expenses that happen at Christmas time.
Sure.
Or vacation time. So how many months of the year do I need to track in order to create a realistic budget?
I think that's a great question. I think it often depends on the person. If you use your debit card, you don't really have to track intentionally because you're using your debit card and it actually tracks for you. So if you use a debit card for any amount of time, even over the last 3 weeks, you'll be able to go back and take a highlighter of your favorite color and identify what were some of the high level areas of expense that I have been doing on a consistent basis. So you can have a ballpark figure about how much am I actually spending in that area? And then secondly, was it worth it? You know, and being able to see, oh, if it's not worth it, I can get rid of it. And that's where the beauty of a budget comes in, because it's not telling you you can't do it. It's just telling you when you can and with what money you can. So if you notice that in this season of your life, you're really interested in, say, that it's that extravagant trip. So looking at your past couple of months, or even your past 2 months of expenses, you can see, wow, I've eaten out maybe 4 to 5 times a week, and it has cost me maybe $700 to $800 this month. And that's actually quite impossible. Even if I were to cut that in half, because we don't have to be so drastic in how we interact with our budget, especially if it's something that's new. What if I took half of that money and put it into that sinking fund? So the two are able to exist, and I can still, you know, be able to eat out and still be able to have this long-term treat or this pleasure that I want to, it's worth it, because what's the point of having money if you don't enjoy it? So being able to, one, look at that. So I would say tracking comes with what you can honestly do. And I think if it's your first time tracking, don't pretend you're going to track for 90 days if you haven't tracked for 3. So I would say, look at what's manageable, right? Look at what's manageable for now And no, this isn't a zero-sum game. Next month, you can do 60 days, but I really don't think 60 days is necessary. I think 21 days is enough because you get a general idea about how you're spending. And when you're more intentional about that, you begin to even see how you interact with money on a daily basis. How often am I swiping in my card? And how am I feeling when I do that? You get a more intuitive experience as well. So it's just not a tactical thing. It's an intentional, intuitive thing as well.
Okay, so I have my budget. I know essentially how much I pay every month, recurring expenses. I know about how much I'm spending in terms of variable expenses. So what do I prioritize if I'm trying to pay off debt?
I think that when it comes to paying off debt, you look at the expenses that I just mentioned that you have that have added zero value to your life, right? You realize, I didn't realize I spent that much money on that category. So it could be duplicates in your budget of subscriptions. It could be a gym membership that you never went to. It could be the clothing, maybe a clothing budget that you saw you were spending at a particular place that you never actually, you never wore the clothes. The clothes are still in the closet. You have more than enough clothes. So you can begin to look at the expenses that have not added value to your life. Take that money and put it towards whether it be the high interest credit card that you want to get rid of because you want to save the largest amount the more quickly in terms of interest, or you want the smallest debt eliminated so you can get a quick win. So that's the first way you prioritize. I would say the second place that you prioritize is looking at expenses that can be bundled, for example. Could you actually bundle like your car insurance or your home insurance together if you've used the same company? So there are ways that you can even looking at ways to take what you already have, call the companies, use your consumer power to make it work for you, and then take that money and add it towards debt. I think another place when looking at eliminating debt in your budget is honestly looking at your budget is one, but then looking at your taking inventory of your life. Like, what are some of the things that you have that you never use? And I think that also helps us see, can I sell this? Can I swap this with a friend or a colleague that can give me something I need in exchange so I don't have to purchase it? Can I be content? And I think that's another part of getting out of debt is not getting yourself deeper into debt by being clear and having a sense of gratitude for what you already have. For a lot of us, we have enough things in our pantry. We have enough clothes in our closet that foregoing buying clothes or maybe even supplementing what we have in our fridge and our pantries can save us a lot of money in terms of groceries and in terms of food that a lot of us may overlook because we think we have to get into this habit of going to the grocery store every week or shopping every week. And I would say also, when it comes to eliminating debt, is eliminating the distractions from your budget. So if you have automatic withdrawals that take money away for, say, that subscription or any type of membership that you have that you haven't used in the past 14 days, I would say make sure that you all cancel it and redirect that money toward eliminating debt.
Such great advice. I mean, especially the part about going through your possessions. I think people underestimate the maintenance cost of many of the things that they possess.
Yes.
Sometimes people will buy an item and they don't realize it's actually going to cost when you keep it, even if you're not using it. Okay, so we've made our budget. We've sort of made our priorities. We've set aside the sinking fund. We feel as though we are kind of covered, at least. We've got a good start. What's our intermediate level? What comes after we get all this set up?
Well, I think it's also important, like, you have your emergency fund. So I think that's the next step. If you have your sinking fund and emergency funds that go together, I will say one is more important than the other, but they're equally important. Emergency funds keep you from going deeper into debt because when something happens, you have a job loss or something happens with your car or something happens with your home, rather than putting that usually high cost expense that's unexpected on a credit card and having interest be attached to it, you're able to use the money from your emergency fund. So being clear about your needs for an emergency fund are also important. If you are single and you live at home, your emergency fund needs will be a lot lower than someone who has a family who may be a single parent versus someone who may have two incomes but have several dependents. So thinking about where would make the most sense based on those living expenses and multiplying it by 3, 6, 9, or even 12 months and see if that's a place that you can begin to work towards in terms of an intermediate step. I would say another part of the intermediate step is making sure that any money after you've hit those basic bases is done thought about how can I grow this money? And I think beginning to think about investing as a place to start accelerating the growth for your money is an important part of your wealth process. So being able to feel more comfortable and having a healthy relationship with money. I know when it comes to women, women think that they're not great investors. But in fact, there's so many studies that show that our ability to communicate, our ability to be more patient than our male counterparts actually make us better at investing. And the place that we can invest the first place is with our retirement accounts. Making sure that you talk to your HR person about what are the options for you to invest in the company's retirement plan allows you to put that money away, have it grow tax deferred until you're 59 and a half and be able to see that money grow and feel good about that process of, you know, taking care of yourself in the long term. And then in addition to having a retirement account through your employee-sponsored program, you can think about having a retirement account that you open up as an individual retirement account, whether it be a Roth IRA or a traditional IRA. And the difference between the two is a traditional IRA uses money that is already tax-free. It means that you grow it tax-free in the account, in the brokerage account, whereas Roth IRA money is money that has already been taxed. So when you remove Roth IRA money, the money comes out without being taxed. But with the traditional IRA, you put it in tax-free, but it becomes taxed when you take it out. But honestly, money that grows tax-free is money that grows tax-free and you can enjoy it. So the question is, should I do a Roth or a traditional? Do either. It doesn't make a difference as long as your money is not then sitting in a bank account, even if it is a high-yield savings account, not growing to outpace inflation or just to even market shifts in the last couple of months have shown that the market is doing at least 11%. That's much better than even the best high yield savings account, which does like 4 or 5%.
So I know we're coming to the end of our conversation, but before we go, I wonder if there are any sort of knowns about finances that need to be updated. I mean, those things, those rule of thumbs that we were taught by our parents or even our grandparents, like the right amount of savings is 3 months of your salary. You should pay off your credit card every single month without fail. Are there any of those sort of assumptions that are no longer true?
I would say a lot of them are based on a reality that everyone worked for 30 years at the same company, got a pension, and lived their best lives. And it's, like I said, a different reality. So I think that our grandparents, they're not wrong. They're just not right. You know, I think that what that means, you know, is that there's something to be said about it if you have a similar trajectory. So if you have, say, something like you're a classroom teacher, say, in New York City, and you have a pension and you have a union, and it's more likely that you'd be able to stay in this profession without much change, then sure. Something that grandpa might have said that said, you know, pay off your credit card debt because you have a steady income, you have checks every 2 weeks, it makes sense. But for someone who has a gig economy, or maybe who's trying to grow a business, or someone who is single with children, or someone who wants to maybe try something new when it comes to how they manage their time because they want flexibility in their job. No, it doesn't make sense. You can take a piece of it and say that in general, when it comes to paying off credit card debt, it makes sense to pay off as much as you can because you don't want to have the interest rate, you know, add more of a balance to it. The idea is to be smart with credit. I think that what they're trying to say is be smart with credit. Now, how you be smart with credit, depending on where you are in your finances, may mean that you may have had to put something costly on your credit card, right? You may not be able to pay it off at the end of the month, but you paid 30% towards it and you're not adding any more to that credit card. That's being smart based on the circumstance. So the rules of thumb have to make sense for your life. So I would say those things about paying in full, paying on time make sense when you can. But if you can't pay in full and pay on time, make the smartest decision based on what you're doing and what that decision, what the reason was for making that purchase. I would say that's one. I'd say another possibly outdated rule of thumb from previous generations is staying with the same job for years because of job loyalty. Job hopping has proven to be a great way for men and women to increase their income quickly, you know, 20 and 30% per jump versus trying to show loyalty and, you know, fighting the good fight at one corporation. I think that knowing your worth and being able to articulate that through showing how you've improved the company's bottom line will allow you to increase your income rather than staying at the same job. I would say third, another rule of thumb that may have to be revisited is that buying a home is better than renting. I think that there are many people who don't want to deal with the pressures of home ownership, who rather use their money for something else, and they can build wealth at the same time. So it's not an either or, they're not mutually exclusive. You can be a renter and be wealthy. And I think changing the conversation about the reasons why people buy versus rent and the merits of one or the other, depending on where you are in your life, have to also accompany those heuristics so they make sense and they don't exclude people who may traditionally have thought it made sense, but now because there's new ways of thinking, they may have to try something new.
Before we go, any words of encouragement for someone who might be listening and just feels overwhelmed by even thinking about all this, feels scared?
Yeah, I think that it's normal to feel scared, number one. We all feel scared in some kind of way when something is new or something is difficult for us to understand. I would say, two, you don't have to do it alone. I think finding community is an important piece of being able to move from being scared, and being scared and doing it anyway is the next step. No one says you have to be completely confident in order to heal your relationship with money or be completely confident in order to do some of the things that you want to do with money. And I think that in the doing, that's where the confidence comes. I think in the doing, that's where the healing comes as well. So I would leave them with that. And one more thing I will leave is just start small. And you don't have to completely transform all the aspects of your finances all at one time. Maybe you want to start off with just looking at your tracking even before you start creating a budget. Maybe you just want to identify the number of credit cards you have before actually getting the total of debt that you have. You can take small baby steps, and baby steps are still steps. So whether that means talking to your HR person just to get an overview of what your options are before actually making a plan, that's okay because you're moving in the right direction. And I think the direction is just as important as the pace. So if you're moving in the right direction, even if it's slow, it's a good thing because you're at least moving.
Thank you so much. This has been really enlightening. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
We hope you enjoyed this conversation with Kara Stevens. It is never too late or too early in your career to start managing your finances like a pro. We hope this show helps you kickstart some new habits. The Conferences for Women is the largest network of women's conferences in the nation. They draw more than 55,000 women and men to annual events in Boston, Philadelphia, Austin, and California, and online. Listeners in Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, and the rest of the country, here is your heads up that registration will open for the Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, and National Conferences for Women this May. Visit conferencesforwomen.org to sign up for email updates. I'm Celeste Headley. This is Women Amplified from the Conferences for Women. Thank you so much for listening. Be kind and be well.